Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Free Culture Radio, Human Rights Day. Ever since it was first observed in 1950, December 10th is Human Rights Day. It commemorates the anniversary of the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, which set out, for the first time, fundamental human rights to be universally protected. Now, if there are first-time listeners out there, you may be asking, "But Doug, this is a show about drugs. What do drugs have to do with human rights?" Well, as long-time listeners know, the answer to that question is that drug user rights are human rights, because people who use drugs are people. As a society, we tend to lose sight of that fact once in a while. Thus, we stigmatize, brutalize, and even criminalize the use of some drugs. But I digress. Human Rights Day was December 10th. The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights held a news conference on December 10th to mark that day. That event opened with an address by the High Commissioner for Human Rights himself, Volker Türk. Here he is.
So, what can I tell you? Human rights, underfunded, undermined, under attack. And yet, powerful, undeterred, mobilizing. This year, no doubt, has been a difficult one. And one full of dangerous contradictions. Funding for human rights has been slashed, while anti-rights movements are increasingly well-funded. Profits for the arms industry are soaring, while funding for humanitarian aid and grassroots civil society plummets. Those defending rights and justice are attacked, sanctioned, and hauled before courts, even as those ordering the commission of atrocity crimes continue to enjoy impunity. Diversity, equity, and inclusion policies that were adopted to address historical and structural injustices are being vilified as unjust. The prognosis would be incredibly dire if these were the only trends. But the pushback on human rights is facing pushback from a groundswell of human rights activism. In Nepal, Serbia, Madagascar, Kenya, Bangladesh, Ecuador, Paraguay, the Philippines, Indonesia, Tanzania, Morocco, Peru, and beyond, mostly young people have taken to the streets and to social media against inequalities, against corruption or repression, in favor of freedom of expression, and for their everyday essentials, and in particular their rights. People across the world have also been protesting against war and injustice and demanding climate action in places far from home, expressing solidarity and pressuring their governments to take action. I urge governments around the world to harness the energy of these social movements into opportunities for broader transformational reforms rather than rushing to suppress them or label them as extremist threats to national security. They are, in fact, the exact opposite of threats to national security. On the challenges I had set out earlier, here is some data. Funding. Our resources have been slashed, along with funding of four human rights organizations, including at the grassroots level around the world. We are in survival mode, and I was in Brussels yesterday during a meeting with human rights defenders, and all of them, all the human rights defenders from around the world, told me how dire their situation is. My office has had about $90 million less than we needed this year, which means around 300 jobs have been lost and essential work has had to be cut, including in our operation in Colombia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Myanmar, Tunisia, and other countries at a time when the needs are rising. Special rapporteur country visits and investigative missions by fact-finding bodies have also been reduced, sometimes drastically. Crucial dialogues with states on their compliance with human rights treaties, the so-called treaty body system. These sessions had to be postponed. Last year, there were 145 state party reviews. we are down to 103 this year. And this has consequences. They may not be seen immediately, but they are going to be felt. We see that all of this has extensive ripple effects on international and national efforts to protect human rights. Meanwhile, anti-rights and anti-gender movements are increasingly coordinated and well-funded, operating across borders. According to the European Parliamentary Forum for Sexual and Reproductive Rights, for example, almost $1.2 billion was mobilized by anti-rights groups in Europe between 2019 and 2023. There is significant money flowing into the anti-rights agenda from funders based in Europe, Russia, and the United States of America. Such massive funding, coupled with media capture and disinformation strategies, have made the anti-rights agenda a powerful cross-regional force. Another distressing data set is that from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, CIPRI. It says, and it's the latest report, that arms and military service revenues for the 100 largest arms companies reached a record of $679 billion in 2024. CIPRI has said demand was boosted by wars in Ukraine and Gaza, by global and regional geopolitical tensions, and ever higher military expenditure. There have been efforts this year to secure ceasefires and peace deals, which are certainly welcome. However, for peace to be sustainable, human rights must play a central role. There is a human rights imperative that needs to feed into any ceasefire and peace negotiation. From prevention to negotiation to monitoring to accountability to recovery and peace building. And we need to do a reality check. In Gaza, in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, and now, as we have just seen over the last couple of days between Thailand and Cambodia, agreements have yet to translate into effective protection of civilians on the ground. Gaza remains a place of unimaginable suffering, loss, and fear. While the bloodshed has reduced, it has not stopped. Attacks by Israel continue, including on individuals approaching the so-called yellow line, residential buildings and IDP tents and shelters, as well as other civilian objects. Access to essential services and goods remain severely inadequate. In the West Bank, we are seeing unprecedented levels of attack by Israeli forces and settlers against Palestinians, forcing them from their land. This is a time to intensify pressure and advocacy, not to sink into complacency for Palestinians across the occupied territory. Clashes between the DRC armed forces and the Rwandan-backed M23 armed group continue, alongside serious human rights violations and abuses. Civilians again are bearing the brunt. Overnight, you will have seen, there have been reports of thousands fleeing the densely populated South Kivu city of Uvira amid escalating clashes between the M23 and DRC armed forces backed by Wazalendo militia. This comes just days after the DRC and Rwanda reaffirmed their commitment to implement the June 2025 Washington Peace Agreement. Over the years, we have documented outrageous violations against civilians in Uvira, including rape and sexual and gender-based violence. The risk of a broader regional confrontation appears to be increasing. In Sudan, the brutal conflict between the army and the rapid support forces continues unabated. From Darfur and the Kordofan to Khartoum and Omdurman and beyond, no Sudanese civilian has been left untouched by the cruel and senseless violence. I'm extremely worried, and I say it again, that we may see a repeat of the atrocities committed in Al-Fashir in Kordofan. In Ukraine, civilian harm has risen sharply. Civilian casualties so far this year are 24% higher than the same period last year, largely due to Russia's increased use of powerful, long-range weapons in large numbers and its continuing efforts across broad front to capture further Ukrainian territory by armed force. Large-scale attacks on Ukraine's energy system have caused emergency outages and prolonged daily electricity cuts, disruptions to water and heating services in many areas. Urgent steps need to be taken to alleviate suffering, including the return of transferred children, the exchange of all prisoners of war, and the unconditional release of civilian detainees held by the Russian authorities. For any sustainable peace to be negotiated, it is important that confidence-building measures are taken, grounded in human rights, including steps to alleviate civilian suffering, promote accountability, and preserve a basis for further dialogue. And importantly, women need to be part of this process. It is imperative that peace deals and ceasefires are secured and implemented in good faith and with full respect for international law, which can never be set aside for political convenience. It is also critical to counter the demonization of and hate-mongering rhetoric against migrants and refugees. In various countries, worryingly, we are seeing violent pushbacks, large-scale raids, arrests and returns without due process, criminalization of migrants and refugees and those who support them, as well as the outsourcing of responsibilities under international law. I urge states to embark on an evidence-based policy debate on migration and refugee issues that are anchored in international human rights and refugee law. In the course of many electoral campaigns this year, we have also seen a pattern of democratic backsliding, restrictive civic space, and electoral violence. Myanmar's upcoming military-imposed election, under quotation marks, is accompanied by new waves of acute insecurity and violence, continued arrests and detentions of opponents, voter coercion, the use of extensive electronic surveillance tools, and systematic discrimination. I fear that this process will only further deepen insecurity and fear and polarization throughout the country. There is unfortunately never a shortage of human rights challenges to face, issues to resolve, and values to defend. But what is heartening is that there are so many of us around the world attached to the same universal human rights values, no matter the noise, the gaslighting, and the persistent injustices. I am energized by the people who I've met across the world, including those who participate in social movements, particularly the ones who are led by young people. They are writing the latest chapters in the time-honored struggle for our collective humanity and dignity. Journalists, activists, human rights defenders have been at the forefront of the global movement for freedom, equality, and justice. Such perseverance has achieved landmark victories for the rights of women, migrants, people discriminated against on the basis of descent, minorities, our environment, and so much more. And we will continue to persevere. Thank you very much.
That was Volker Türk, High Commissioner for Human Rights, speaking at a news conference in Geneva on December 10th to mark Human Rights Day. We'll hear more in a moment. I'm Doug McVeigh, and this is Free Culture Radio. Welcome back. On today's show, we're looking at Human Rights Day, which was December 10th. The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights held a news conference on December 10th to mark that day. In the first half of the show, we heard the statement by the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk. He also took some questions, so let's hear a bit of that. Three journalists ask their questions at a time, and then the High Commissioner replies. The journalists introduce themselves in this next segment.
Thank you very much. Guten Tag, Herr Türk. Christiane Ulrich, German Press Agency. You were talking about the anti-rights and anti-gender movements. Can you be a bit more specific? Who exactly are you talking about and who is funding these? You were talking about them being increasingly well-funded. Thank you.
Laurence Hiro, Swiss News Agency. Thanks for that usual press conference. A few days ago, the Trump administration unveiled a new national security strategy, which looks like an attempt to interfere in the democratic life and the civic space and civic liberties of hundreds of millions of citizens throughout Europe. How concerned are you by that? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Turk, for the press conference. Antonio Proto from F Spanish News Agency. I have some questions about Venezuela. Do you believe that an international mechanism should be created to investigate the U.S. attacks against alleged drug traffickers, which appear to involve multiple human rights violations, including extrajudicial killings and disproportionate use of force? And more broadly, what is your position on the U.S. government's open threats of military action against Venezuela? Thank you.
Look, on the anti-rights and, if you like, anti-gender movement that we see, it is indeed one of my biggest worries, because we have detected some of this in various parts of the world. What I have referred to is indeed the European Parliamentary Forum, which did, and I would refer you to their report and we can share it with you, which have documented this, and they have been able to document it in terms of the funding that goes into it. But this is, I think, just the tip of the iceberg. We have heard around the world that a lot more funding goes into well-organized cross-regional strategies to push back on gender issues and more broadly on human rights issues. And it affects in particular gender equality, LGBTIQ+, sexual and reproductive rights, rights of migrants and refugees, but also climate action. And what I think we need to be aware of is that there is this well-funded way of doing it, and that's why I refer to that particular report. And we need to be very vigilant about it, because it also is a distraction from the very normative system that has been established at the moment that we have, and that is non-ideological, because sometimes human rights are seen as an ideology, but they are not. They are not partisan. They are the normative framework of our social contract, and we need to be very careful when this part of the social contract is in jeopardy. On the issue of the just recently issued national security strategy, when it comes to Europe, I mean, Europe is a continent that, not least given the history of the continent, has benefited precisely from the promotion and protection of human rights. It was one of the first continents to establish it, in fact, is still the first continent to establish a human rights system that is one of the strongest in the world, because you have a European Court for Human Rights in Strasbourg, European Convention for Human Rights, and that convention has served Europe extremely well, because it has precisely dealt with some of the issues, some of the dilemmas that are often discussed in this transatlantic relationship of late, including issues of freedom of expression. When it comes to freedom of expression, it's absolutely clear there are limits to it when it comes to hate speech, harmful disinformation, the incitement to violence. So I hope that all those who look at that strategy and you analyze it are doing it very much in recognition of the incredible path that Europe, and in particular the European Union, have had over the last couple of decades to build indeed a continent that is built on peace, human rights and dignity, with all the issues that there are. As always, there are issues, but it's important to honor that incredible achievement for humanity. When it comes to Venezuela, and in particular, not so much Venezuela, I mean, obviously concerned about the tensions that there that exist. It's clear that, I mean, my overarching concern is the human rights issues in Venezuela themselves. I have been extremely vocal about how we see the situation. We also know that any escalation is not in the interest of anyone. And so our call is always for de-escalation, for finding a way to deal with this through constructive engagement between the two countries. When it comes to the events, especially what you refer to in the Caribbean, I've been extremely clear. I consider them a violation of international law, in particular international human rights law. I have asked for prompt, independent investigations. We have seen a debate now in the US, in Congress as well, about these strikes, and I hope that they will lead to a prompt, serious investigation that is independent, so that we can get to the bottom of what has happened there.
That was the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, responding to questions at a news conference December 10th held to commemorate Human Rights Day. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Turning from the UN offices in Geneva, Switzerland, to the floor of the U.S. Senate in Washington, D.C., also on December 10th, here's Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat from Oregon.
Launching another reckless war to depose an authoritarian leader in South America is not an America first strategy. And without congressional authorization, it's unconstitutional. The prelude to this military action has been military strikes on boats off the coast of Venezuela. The administration has said they are acting to stop these boats from delivering narcotics. Well, there's a legal way to do that. And then there's an illegal way to do it. The legal way is for the Coast Guard to intercept the boats, to search them, arrest those present should narcotics be found. And the illegal way is to simply blow up boats in international waters. The legal path is the right way to go. The Coast Guard makes arrests, which allow them to collect evidence and information for broader counter-narcotics operations. Destroying boats and killing those aboard means no evidence or information that confers evidence of what was undertaken. Was it even a narcotics operation to begin with? It is either a war crime or it's a murder. It is a violation of our law. It is a violation of international law. We have a stake in the structure of international law because we want our troops to be treated in a right manner, not to be executed when they are out of the action, laying wounded on a battlefield, not to be murdered clinging to a debris after their boat has been blown up. Our military forces don't summarily execute others because we don't want others to summarily execute our forces. That's the principle involved. So the president's extraterritorial, extrajudicial killings in the Caribbean are terrible policy, terrible principles, and a terrible precedent. And we are in a bizarre moment. Bizarre. President Trump, while saying he's trying to intercept drugs, just pardoned the kingpin who organized the narcotic superhighway that delivered 400 to 500 tons of cocaine to the United States of America. Juan Orlando Hernandez of Honduras, former president, convicted on overwhelming evidence of moving massive drugs to the United States of America, pardoned by President Trump. If you want to stop narcotics, you don't go around releasing the kingpins who organized this devastating assault on our nation. On November 29th, President Trump said that the Venezuelan airspace should be considered closed in its entirety, and commercial flights have been greatly reduced as a result. On December 2nd, Trump said the military strikes would, quote, start very soon, and, quote, we're going to start doing those strikes on land. So we don't have a moment to waste. to be here on the floor of the Senate defending the Constitution to ensure that the will of the people on issues of war are respected. If my colleagues want there to be a declaration of war, then bring that to the floor of the Senate, because that's what the Constitution says. And let's debate that. And let's see if there's a majority vote for that. And let's send it over to the House of Representatives and see if they agree, because we took an oath to the Constitution. Thus, I've come to the floor to ask unanimous consent for the Senate to pass the Prohibiting Unauthorized Military Action in Venezuela Act. Again, I thank my co-sponsors, Senator Kaine and Van Hollen, and also Brooks, Welch, Markey, and Sanders, who are stalwart defenders of the Constitution and the constitutional responsibility for Congress, not the President, to authorize war. The bill prohibits any federal funding from being used for the United States to wage war against Venezuela. To be clear, the bill does not prevent the U.S. from defending itself or its citizens against an armed attack. It does not prevent lawful counter-narcotics operations. It does not prevent humanitarian assistance to the Venezuelan people. But it does protect and defend our Constitution's essential separation of powers.
That was Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat from Oregon, speaking on the Senate floor December 10th about S-3344, a bill he introduced on December 4th entitled the Prohibiting Unauthorized Military Action in Venezuela Act. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Many thanks to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it, and you make it all possible. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for community radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Links are at the website kboo.fm/freeculture, along with an archive of past shows. Theme music for Free Culture Radio is composed and performed by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare and is used with permission of the artist. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! Oh, my God.